the speaker in a moment, but just note that next week we have a talk which is going to be given by Dr. Stephen Miller, classical archaeology, talking about the excavations of Nemea, and this, of course, is in the context of the Olympics that are coming. The talk tonight is sponsored by Craig LaRange, and he has sponsored a series, one per year, of lectures in the Vancouver Institute, in joint with the University of Wisconsin, and this is the first of these. And so would like to especially thank Craig LaRange for this sponsorship. And he is here this evening, so perhaps we could have a... And we have a season sponsor as well, Odlum Brown, as you can see up here on the board. This lecture is given by Jamie Thompson. And Jamie is with us from the University of Wisconsin, as I've just said. He received his bachelor's degree in biophysics from the University of Illinois, doctorate in veterinary medicine, and also from the University of Pennsylvania, PhD, in molecular biology. He then did a postdoc for 2 years in Oregon. He's currently the John D. MacArthur Professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He's also an adjunct professor in the Department of Molecular, Cellular, and Developmental Biology at the University of California in Santa Barbara. And he's the director of regenerative biology and a principal scientist at the Morgridge Institute for Research at the University of Wisconsin. Dr. Thompson directed the pioneering group that reported the first isolation of embryonic stem cell lines from a non-human primate in 1995, and this work led his group to the first successful isolation of the human embryonic stem cell lines in 1998. His group has subsequently been involved in demonstrating the developmental potential of human stem cells in lineage-specific differentiation, such as blood, trophoblast, neural tissue, and heart. The current focus of his laboratory is on understanding how embryonic stem cells can form any cell in the body and how cells choose between self-renewal and the initial decision to differentiate, and how a differentiated cell with limited developmental potential can be reprogrammed to a pluripotent cell. His work has applications in basic research, in drug discovery, and transplantation medicine. Please welcome our speaker.
I'd like to thank you for the invitation and for Craig for coming up with the money that makes me come here, because it's a beautiful place. So what I'm going to try to accomplish tonight is talk about human pluripotent stem cells, and they come in two flavors now. Person listening to the mic, can you turn it up a little bit? They're having trouble hearing out there. No, I can't. Okay, how's that? You turned it up a little bit? No? He's saying yes here. Okay, now it's good. Okay, so I want to talk about two different kinds of pluripotent stem cells, embryonic stem cells, and these newer cells called reprogrammed cells or iPS cells. And what I want to accomplish is tell you where they come from, what their properties are, and why we think they're important for biomedical research. And I've been told this is a very diverse audience. It ranges from people that are professional scientists to a lot of people that haven't had science courses, but that you all are very well-educated, and you can follow what I'm going to say, I hope. We'll see. So where do they come from? Mouse embryonic stem cells were derived actually way back in the early 1980s. And if you look at the first week or so of development in mammals, whether you're mouse or human, it looks like what's on the slide here. And right after fertilization, there's a single cell. And that single cell goes from 1 to 2 to 4 to 8. And during each of these divisions, each of those cells basically doesn't know what they want to be when they grow up. They don't look or act like heart cells or nerve cells or anything else. And importantly, they maintain the potential to form all those things. So they're unrestricted in the things that they become. Now, in the intact embryo, right after implantation, this potential goes away. These cells start to become other things, and once they become other things, they lose the potential to become other things. But if you take them out of the embryo and you put them under appropriate conditions, they'll proliferate as far as we know forever, and they'll maintain this very important embryonic property of being able to form everything in the whole body. This property is called pluripotency, the title of the talk. So this was done in the early 1980s with mice, and then there's a gap. A bunch of people tried to do this with other species and failed. And it turns out mice are kind of special in the growth factors they need to keep these cells going. But the reason I got interested in this originally is basically this slide, which I drew a lot of years ago. And I'm assuming there's very few embryologists in the audience. But if you just look back and forth at the colors, this embryo doesn't look like that embryo very much, does it? And this is the human version, and that's the mouse version. And they're actually drawn at the same developmental stage. And if you just go back and forth with your eyes in the same colors, you can see that they're just not looking quite the same. So if you look at this yellow thing out here, it's kind of a double-layered thing. That's the yolk sac. And if you look at particular tissues like this green stuff out here, that's the outer layer of the placenta. It has a technical name called the trophoblast. The structure and function of the mouse placenta and the human placenta is just dramatically different. And if you do a pregnancy test, you're actually measuring a particular hormone called chorionic gonadotropin. And that's a very essential hormone for establishing and maintaining pregnancy. And the mouse doesn't even have that hormone. It uses an entirely different mechanism doing that. So if you're interested in the normal events of human development and human pregnancy, the mouse has a lot of things going for it, and a lot of developmental biologists use it. But there's some of these things that are just wrong. So in spite of the fact that mouse embryonic stem cells have been derived in the 80s, I got interested in primates because if you looked at, say, a rhesus monkey, which is what's on the right there, and you looked at the same developmental stage I just showed you, you wouldn't be able to tell them apart from humans. They're very, very similar. The problem, however, dealing with monkeys, one, there's ethical issues in dealing with them. A lot of people think we shouldn't use them at all for this kind of thing. But also, it's extremely expensive, and it's difficult to do. So when I was doing this work in the early 1990s, one single embryo, like I showed you in the previous slide, for rhesus monkey, cost about $2,000. So you couldn't do experiments with hundreds of embryos because you never had enough material to do it. So the amount of information you can glean was actually very limited. So this was the original reason back in the 90s I wanted to derive embryonic stem cells from this primate species. Because what embryonic stem cells are is something you can grow forever in a tissue culture dish, make as much as you want to, and you could still model some of these early developmental decisions. So we're successful in 1995 with the rhesus monkey, which is what was shown here. And like I said, that was kind of a milestone because up until that point, from the early 1980s to 1995, there were no other embryonic stem cells except for the mouse. And it turns out you just need a different set of growth factors to do this. And the following year, I was successful with a different primate species called the marmoset. And marmosets are from South America, and they were called New World species, and rhesus monkeys are Old World species. And there's a very big evolutionary divide between Old World and New World monkeys. It's a basic divide in primate species. And if you look at the evolutionary distance between marmosets, this one, and rhesus monkeys, it's actually further than evolutionary distance between rhesus monkeys and people, for example. So we're successful in making primate embryonic stem cells from this New World species in 1996. And because we had both an Old World and New World species and the same stuff worked, we're actually pretty sure the human embryonic stem cells could be derived. And I remember when I started this, I wasn't even planning to do that. I was trying to just make a better in vitro model using primates. And primate embryonic stem cells do provide a pretty close model for understanding human development. But clearly, human material provides the most accurate model. So this was accomplished in 1998. And especially in the United States and probably in Canada, too, it created quite a political stir. And I was actually surprised at how quickly it erupted, because the paper describing this was in November of 1998, and I had to testify before the U.S. Senate in December of 1998, so it was a very rapid response. And I was also surprised at how long it lasted. It lasted throughout the Bush administration in the United States for 8 years. But Harold Varmus at that time was NIH director of National Institutes of Health in the United States, and he had to testify before Congress also. And he made the statement back then, which I think is still basically true, is that the development of cell lines that produce almost every tissue of the human body is an unprecedented scientific breakthrough. It is not too unrealistic to say that this research has the potential to revolutionize the practice of medicine and improve the quality of length of life. And although I think that statement's true, I think that what can and can't be done has been so incredibly hyped in the press that there's kind of a mismatch between public perceptions and what can actually be done. So I want to spend basically this whole lecture to tell you what these cells can do and what they can't do and what I think their limitations probably are. I should back up a little bit. I should mention this. The reason clearly why this is so controversial is that human embryos were used for this research. And the embryos that we used were produced in in vitro fertilization clinics where couples were undergoing infertility treatment, but at the end of their treatment, they no longer wished to use embryos for fertility. At Wisconsin, we gave them the option to donate to other couples, to simply discard the embryos, to donate them to research, or continue to store them. And a subset of the couples decided to donate to this research. So the embryos that we used are ones that would otherwise have been discarded 10 years ago. So there's basically two properties of why these cells are so important. The first one is they'll divide, as far as we know, forever. And this is unusual for human cells. If you take like a skin cell and you put it into tissue culture, it'll divide and it'll divide and divide and eventually stop. And typically it'll divide 60, 70 population doubling times, and then it'll undergo something called senescence. So if you take a normal human skin cell and put it in tissue culture, there's a limit to how much you can grow. There's a lot known about the genetics of how that works now, but embryonic stem cells are at such an early stage in development that they don't have those restrictions at all. And as far as we know, we can put these in tissue culture and they'll keep growing and growing and growing and growing. So another kind of cell that'll do that is a cancer cell. And a cancer cell has genetic changes that allow it to do that. But embryonic stem cells are unusual in that they can grow without limit and they're normal. They're not cancer cells and they have the normal complement of genetic material. So that's property number one. You can grow as many as you want to, so you can make lots and lots of these things. The other property is as far as we know, they can make every cell type in the human body. Now, it's actually difficult to show that, but for every cell type we've tested, they can make all the cells that we've tested today. One of the ways that you can show that is to take a mouse that lacks an immune system and inject some of these cells into that mouse. And they'll undergo a very disorganized kind of differentiation where they'll go off in different directions. And you can look at that growth called a teratoma and see what's in there. And this is an example of that. If any of you have had histology, you can recognize this as a little gut-like structure. And the endoderm is one of the basic layers of the embryo. And the interesting thing here is the endoderm is this little layer here. But you can also see this little layer forming around here. That's like smooth muscle of the gut. So this shows that not only do individual cell types, not only do these cells have the ability to form individual cell types, but they can actually communicate between different cell types and form fairly complicated structures. So the three basic germ layers of the body are called endoderm, that's like you're inside your guts. Mesoderm, that's things like bone. This is spicular bone. This is some bone marrow. This is kidney, skeletal muscle, cartilage, all things you've heard of. And then the outer layer is ectoderm, which is things like skin and brain. One of the most advanced differentiation events we've seen is this thing here. And if you look in a histology textbook, that's a tooth bud. And if you actually look, there's a little layer of dentin here that's forming between what are called ameloblasts and adenoblasts. The point here is this is an undifferentiated cell, a very nondescript thing that could be grown in tissue culture for a long time. It's like a year. And if you put it in the proper conditions, you can form something as complicated as a tooth. So they're quite remarkable cells. So why do we care? There are basically three reasons. And the third one is the one that hits the press all the time, and it's the one that I'm least enthusiastic about. The first one, and the one that I'm most interested in, is human ES cells, and these later iPS cells we'll talk about in a second, provide a tissue culture model for understanding the differentiation and function of human tissues. There's simply a lot of cells in our body that scientists have simply not had access to before. And I'll give you some examples in a second, but one of those are heart cells. If you take human heart cells and put them into tissue culture in the laboratory, they don't divide. So there's never been a human heart cell line that you could study because you could never get enough material to do it. And there's a lot of cells in your body like that. So this is the first time that we'll have access to the basic building blocks of the human body in tissue culture in the laboratory. And this is useful for several reasons. One is the second one up here, is the human ES cells provide a purified population of specific differentiated cells for drug discovery and testing. Human heart drugs have never been tested directly in human heart cells until it went to clinical trials because there's never been a way to get human heart cells before. So there's been a whole bunch of clinical trials that end up being toxic to the human heart where the drugs had to be pulled, which is a very late stage for that to happen because companies spend this huge amount of money just to get at that point, and then you had to withdraw everything. There's actually been drugs that got past clinical trials and out into the world that end up being toxic to the human heart, again, because you can never test them directly on human heart material. And you use animal models, and animal models are a good start, but they're not as accurate as using actual human material. So heart is just one example, but any cell in the body can now be tested directly in tissue culture for drug discovery and drug testing. Then the last one is human embryonic stem cells could provide a potentially unlimited source of cells for transplantation therapies. And this is the one you hear about in the press all the time, the idea that we can kind of make replacement parts for things that are broken. And this one I want to talk about a little bit. But my feeling is, although there's a huge potential for this, it's really hard. And I think the public has not been well informed about how hard it really is. So I want to kind of go through a few examples. I'm going to start with the developmental one. I mentioned trophoblast before. That is that green stuff on the outside of the embryo that forms the placenta. So embryonic stem cells, this is a big colony of them. All those little teeny dots in there are the cells, and there's probably, 10,000 or something across this. What I want you to watch is this little outer one here. You can see that there's kind of a different color or different opacity forming here. So this is a two-day time lapse where these are just the ES cells growing in conditions where they stay in this undifferentiated state. And this is one where we added one particular growth factor which has caused them to become a different kind of cell. And so we can study this in great detail. And the question is, what's this different kind of cell? You all know that your genes are encoded on DNA, but all your cells have the same DNA. So the question is, what's different about, say, your heart and your brain, when you all have the same blueprint in the same heart? Well, developmental biologists, their goal in life is to understand what those differences are. And basically, different subsets of your genome, different genes are expressed in your heart, and different genes are expressed in your brain. And that's what makes a brain cell, and a heart cell, a heart cell. So there are tissue-specific genes which we can study. And there's a lot of technology for studying this. One is represented over here, and I won't go into detail here. But we did a time course, just like we did before optically in the last paragraph, where these are different time points. And each one of these rows of things are different genes. And a red one means it's coming up in amount, and a green one means it's going down in amount. And if you look at just a little subset of these, all these red ones here are these trophoblast genes, or placenta kind of genes. So that tells us that that differentiation event, which I showed you in that last picture, is all going to this one lineage, which is part of the placenta. Why that's important is that these are the early stages of human development, and we know remarkably little about this. What we know is based on analogy to the mouse, and what I showed you in the first slide is that the analogy to the mouse is imperfect, to say the least. And this is at a period in development where there's just basically no way to study it. For ethical reasons, you can't go in there directly. Even with abortus material, it's much later. So we're profoundly ignorant about the first few days of development. And embryonic stem cells give us our first little insights of some of the events that are occurring there. So that trophoblast is this layer here, and it forms this stuff out here. And it's what's essential for connecting mom to the placenta and the baby. And so we finally have an in vitro model where we can study these early events, and it'll let us understand better how pregnancy is initiated, how it's maintained, and how normal pregnancies shoot. The flip side of that is understanding birth defects and how pregnancy goes bad. So again, it's not the long-lasting value of these cells is getting access to bits of the human body at all stages of development that scientists simply didn't have access to before, so we can understand it for the first time. So let's talk about the transplantation stuff and then talk about what I think, again, the real value is. There's kind of a range of how difficult this will be. And I'll start with what should be kind of easy and then I'll work to what's kind of hard and come back to that central point that it's really about understanding the body. It's not about physically transplanting stuff. So in the case of leukemia, bone marrow transplants is what you do for leukemic individuals. But if you go out into the bone marrow registries, there's still there's different data from different things, but basically about a third or a half of the people that want such a match can't find one. So those currently don't have any kind of treatment. So there's a tremendous need to find a match for bone marrow transplants beyond what's in the registries today. And although it would be very useful to take the hematopoietic stem cells, which is the thing you transplant in those bone marrow transplants, expand them, this has turned out to be very difficult, although there's been some recent progress there. So it's a stem cell that's it's harder or impossible to grow. So human ES cells differentiate very readily to each of the major blood lineages, and there's several labs, including some here in Vancouver, that study this. And these are some rather older slides now, but this upper right one's not stained. They're simply red because they're red blood cells. The lower right one is stained with something that shows that it's a platelet. So if you think about what the Red Cross is actually collecting when you donate blood, it's predominantly these two cell types, and we can already make them in pretty good quantities. And Igor Sluck and my collaborators just made a bunch of red blood cells, and it turns out you can make red blood cells because they expand readily in tissue culture. So you think about this, blood, whether it's for transfusions or bone marrow transplants, there's already established procedures for doing that. The cell functions by floating around the body, so there's no real complicated three-dimensional structure that you have to recapitulate, and it's a well-established procedure. So for this one, the difficulty is simply making the cells, but actually getting to the body should be relatively easy. So that's at one extreme where things could actually be useful very quickly. At the other extreme is neurological disease, because if you think about how complex your brain is, it's not simply a matter of getting cells back in. You have to connect them up in the right way, and that's very, very challenging. So if you take two of the most popular ones that people talk about, one is Parkinson's disease. It's caused by the death of a very specific neuron called a dopaminergic neuron. It affects over 1 million people in the United States, and a huge amount of health care associated with it. And fetal tissue transplants have been performed over the years, but the source of the tissue is inadequate, and I think it's fair to say the clinical results have not been terribly promising to date. ALS is a second such disease, Lou Gehrig's disease, and it's caused by the death of a very specific neuron called a motor neuron. And again, it's a horrible disease for which there's no treatment now. Sushen Zhang at our institution and several other people at other institutions can already make dopaminergic neurons in quantity from embryonic stem cells today. And they are gearing up to do transplantation in animal models. And there are people who study this that believe that will be successful one day. But I think it's good to be skeptical. Is that these cells in the central nervous system, because dopaminergic neurons are kind of localized, it might be possible to transplant them in a meaningful way. But they still have to connect up right. Now, I think it's much more likely that now that we have these cells for the very first time in tissue culture, it's never been possible to get these before, we can study them. We can understand why they die in the first place. And if you catch a Parkinson's patient early in the progression of the disease, you could stop it, that's fine. They'll live a long, productive life. It's trying to repair the damage once it's done that's likely to be very challenging, because once you destroy the structure, redoing the structure is very difficult. That's similar to ALS. Motor neurons can be about a meter long, and they go all over your spinal cord down to your large leg muscles, for example. And while it might be possible one day to rewire it in a way that's functional, it's far better to understand why they're dying and prevent that process in the first place before it goes too far. And again, this is the very first time we've had those neurons in tissue culture in quantity. So that's a big change. Heart disease is kind of in between blood and neural degeneration. I think it's a doable one that's likely to be challenging but achievable. The United States and most developed countries is number one killer. It kills a huge number of people, and there's a lot of health care costs associated. There's a severe shortage of heart donors to treat the end-stage heart failure, so there's a big interest in actually transplanting these cells. And human ES cells differentiate quite readily to cardiomyocytes. People can make essentially unlimited quantities of them today. But other than transplanting these cells, which I think will be difficult, as I mentioned before, there's been a whole bunch of drugs that run into problems once you got to the human heart. And one of the major bad actors is a phenomenon called acquired long QT syndrome. And if you look at these traces here, you can see that you get this kind of regular beat moving along, and then all of a sudden things go kind of nuts in here. This phenomenon has been traced to one particular ion channel in the human heart. And this is from a lady, an 81-year-old lady, who collapsed in church. She was immediately rushed to the clinics at Wisconsin where they took this EKG. And it turned out she had taken an antihistamine called estemisol. So this is something for the sniffles, basically, not a heart drug, nothing to do with the heart whatsoever. And nonetheless, this drug estemisol blocked that ion channel in a way that caused this problem. Now, if you actually look at the blood pressure here, it's kind of going good, good, if she didn't correct here, she would have died because this isn't compatible with life. So this is a case where a drug that was developed for something entirely unrelated to the heart ended up being toxic to the human heart. And because of this woman and studies around it, this drug had to be withdrawn to the market. And it turns out that there's a whole bunch of drugs like this. Estemisol is one here. All the ones with the little red marks here, these are the ones that are actually out of clinics, or out in the market, and had to be withdrawn because of this effect. The yellow ones are ones that are metabolic products, and these orange ones are ones that are really bad, but they have conditions that are so serious that they take the risk in spite of that. So look at, this is a very large list already, and this is all because it's been possible to test drugs directly on human heart in a meaningful way up until now. So we took some of that human heart, which I showed you in that video a second ago, and collaborators Tim Camp and Craig January looked for whether this particular channel, the channel that gets blocked by these bad drugs, is active and whether it could be measured. And I won't go into electrophysiology here, but basically the difference between the little yellow line and the red line means that you can measure that ion channel. So this is not limited to the human heart, but any particular cell in the human body that the drugs may interfere with in a bad way, and also any cell in the body that you want to use as a target to discover drugs. This is the first time we can actually do that. And I think that is going to change human medicine more than transplantation. And the reason is that transplantation, I believe, is going to be hard. If you look at all these reasons here, one challenge is making the cell type of interest. We don't know how to make all the cells in the body, even though these cells probably have that potential. We're actually pretty good at that. Developmental biologists have made a tremendous amount of strides in the last 10 years or so, and there's a lot of cells we can make. And I'd guess in the next decade or so, we can make essentially all the clinically relevant cells in the body, because there's a lot of people working on this. But I also think that the other challenges are much harder. Safety concerns is a big one. If you think about a diabetic patient, that's because there's a very specific cell in the pancreas that's killed, a pancreatic beta cell. And it's very attractive to think, well, we can just make some of those and put the beta cells back. And there's a lot of groups working in that, and I think it'll ultimately work. But whenever you take cells and you put them to tissue culture and they're dividing, there's errors. And these are mutations that occur because every time a cell divides, there's an error rate. So if you grow them enough, there's going to be a lot of mutations occurring. The question is, how many are occurring? And you get so many that it can cause a cancer, that's a big problem. Because if you think of a kid with diabetes, they have a long life ahead of them. And the end of life, there's a lot of problems associated with diabetes. It's a bad disease, but they have a long, productive life. On the other hand, pancreatic cancer is something that kills you in about 3 months. It's a very nasty disease. So you have to be really, really certain when you put cells back in, you don't create something that's worse than what you're trying to cure in the first place. So in the case of diabetes, I think this will ultimately work, don't get me wrong. But I think the safety concerns will mean we have to go slow. Because you even have like a 1% chance of getting cancer, that's not acceptable because, you know, that kills you quickly. So I think that'll slow down a number of ones will work. Immune rejection means that when you do like a heart transplant or bone marrow transplant, you got to be matched in some way and it's immunosuppressive. There's no difference about these cells. They have to be matched. There still has to be immunosuppressive drugs. I've never seen this as a deal stopper because there's some, especially for particular tissues, immunosuppressive therapy works pretty well. But the last two I think are. I think they're very challenging. One of the big ones is preventing the process that killed the cells in the first place. You have some physiologic process that they're dying for some reason. So in the case of diabetes, it's an autoimmune process. Your immune system attacks those cells and they die. If you put the same exact cells in, there's already good evidence they're going to be killed again. So you have to correct the underlying problem before you put the cells in the first place. And this is a very disease-specific thing. And for a bunch of diseases, we don't understand the underlying problem well enough to do this. And related to this, is which I mentioned before, is integration in a physiologically useful form. So for blood cells, they're just floating around. That's going to be an easy one. But for something like the heart, it has to be integrated in a way that actually is connected up with all its neighbors and beating in the right way. That's going to be a little hard. And something like the central nervous system, you've got to get everything connected up just right, and that's going to be really hard. So my feeling is that all these things are possible, but they're going to be much more challenging than people generally talk about. I want to switch gears here. And our world changed about 2 years ago. So as I mentioned before, embryonic stem cells come from part of an early embryo that has the ability to make everything. You culture them in a way that they maintain that ability and they can grow forever in that state. And they can make blood and neurons and other stuff. Developmental biologists really used to think that it was a one-way street, which went from a one cell up into our bodies. You couldn't go backwards. Dolly changed our minds. Remember when they cloned Dolly about a decade ago? What you did was you took a cell that was from a differentiated organ and you put it into oocyte, and somehow that oocyte could reprogram that back to that ground state. So the message of Dolly was not that you can clone sheep or that you can clone people, is you can go backwards. And it was just a matter of time after Dolly before we figured out how to make it go backwards. And the general consensus was it's going to be really hard and take decades, but it turned out it was easier than everybody thought. And remember how I mentioned that there's genes that are specific to like heart and specific to brain cells? Well, it's true of these embryonic stem cells also. So I'm going to take you through where where this process came from. But basically, you can take a little sample of skin, put some genes on it, culture them in the right way, and get something which we can't tell apart from embryonic stem cells. So all the properties that just went through before, being able to grow forever and form every cell type in the body, as far as we know, they're the same as embryonic stem cells. There might be subtle differences, but the basic properties are the same. And I did this in my lab. Actually, I said Junying Yu did this in my lab. At the time I did embryonic stem cells, I did all that myself, but during the 10 years in between, there's now a lot of other people that do the work, and Junying was the one that did this work. And what she did is she took embryonic stem cells and she took some blood cells. And in collaboration with the Vancouver Genome Center here, we looked at all the genes expressed in both of them and subtracted the two. And then she isolated and cloned 250 of the ones that were specific to the embryonic stem cells. And then she asked the question, could sets of that 250, if we put them in the other cell type, make that other cell type more like an embryonic stem cell? So with 250, it's actually a very hard thing to do. So she made little subsets, and the first subset that she used was a set of 14 genes, which are listed here. And she took these 14 genes and put it into a blood cell and then said, what are the properties of that thing after you put the 14 genes in? It turns out that it went back to being in an embryonic stem cell-like state. So the colony morphology was the same, expressed the same kind of markers, and those teratomas I talked to you about, it could do that. So it looked like this is working. Then we had to go from those 14 factors, which is our first shot at it, and figure out which one actually mattered, and that took us about a year and a half to do. But it turned out there's only about 4 of the original 14. And how you look at this little graph is this is all 4 together, and this is the number of these undifferentiated colonies you get when you take a cell from the adult, dump these 4 factors on, and then count the number of new ones you got, like embryonic stem cells. And these are the 4 factors, so if you take one out of them out, it reduces the frequency a little bit. If you took this one out, it completely wipes it out. You take this one out, reduces the frequency. So it's 2 essential ones and then 2 that change the frequency quite a lot. But all 4 together, you can reliably change a differentiated cell back to an undifferentiated state. And when you look at these cells, they have all the properties of embryonic stem cells. So the original cell are called fibroblasts. They're long and stringy, and they look like that. And when you program them, they look like that, which is just like that original colony I showed you in the time-lapse movie. And they have normal karyotypes, which means they have the normal genetic material. And importantly, they make the same exact kind of teratomas that those original embryonic stem cells do. So, for example, this is neural ectoderm, so things that make nerves, cartilage, and gut tissue. So this is very good, and it certainly changed everybody's conception about how hard this is to do. When we originally did this, to get genes into cells, you use things that are called vectors. They're the things that carry the genes into the cells. And the vectors we originally used would take the gene and actually insert it into the genome of the cell. That's bad for a couple of reasons, because it can kind of disrupt a normal gene, because you don't know where they're going in, and once this new thing comes in, it can disrupt what's in there. The other thing is that those extra genes are still there. So we have a cell that's very much like embryonic stem cells, but you have these extra genes in there. So it'd be much better if you could reprogram without having those extra genes disrupting the DNA. So we came up with a strategy, which I won't go into the details, but it was a different kind of vector that's a little circle. And the little circle will go into the cell, but never physically integrate into the genome. It just float around. And then when it's did its job, we have a way to get the circle out again. So we had the 4 genes again, put them into the cell. They reprogrammed back to this undifferentiated state that was stable, and then the little circles could come out and look just like an embryonic stem cell. So again, this is another one of those sets of genes, but the embryonic stem cells and these new, what are called iPS cells, are the same set of genes, and they have the same developmental potential. So why do we care again? And I'm giving you the same slide again. So these new, I've had a lot to digest there. Embryonic stem cells and these new cells, which are called iPS cells, have the same basic properties. The only difference is where they came from. So they have the ability to proliferate forever and the ability to form everything in the whole body. One came from an embryo and one came from an adult cell that was tricked into thinking it was like an embryonic cell. But it's permanently like that now. And if you look at the two of them together, we have no test to distinguish them. They're just one's like the other, or they might find something wrong in the future. So this is a slide I just copied from before for the embryonic stem cell for iPS cells. The point is here is that although the source is different, the same challenges remain. The same reasons why they're important remain. They're the same ground state. The big difference, and this is a huge one, is that with these new reprogrammed cells, you have complete control over the genetic background of the cell line. So with embryonic stem cells, they would come from IVF embryos. You'd never have any idea of the way they were donated, what the genetic background was. With these iPS cells, you can go into a population and actually say, well, I want to represent the ethnic diversity of that population. So for example, if you want to test drugs that is going to be put into a particular population, you'd like a good representation of the people you can put the drugs on in your test. And with these new iPS cells, you can go and take some of these skin fibroblasts from a nice representation of your population, make these cells, make the heart cells, and test them in a way that replicates the genetics. So that's a big difference. Other than that, they're essentially the same cells with the same problems and challenges. Now, because of this control over genetics, you can do it for normal population, but you can also look for abnormalities and suddenly model those abnormalities in a much better way in the laboratory. So spinal muscle atrophy is a disease very much like ALS, but it's early onset. It's a terrible disease of childhood. It's an autosome recessive disorder. Carrier frequency is very high. It's the most common genetic cause of infant death in the United States. And it's caused by a mutation in a very particular gene called SMN1. And SMN1 protein is crucial for motor neuron survival for ways that people don't know yet. It's not understand how this gene works. And it's a good developmental model to show that you can use these reprogrammed cells to model human genetics in a tissue culture dish. So we made some of these newer reprogrammed cells from an individual that carried this genetic defect and one from their sibling. So we had a matched one that was normal and an abnormal to compare the two together. And when we looked at this, we were able to, this is Clive Sensen's work, we were able to make motor neurons, just like I showed you in that previous slide. But when we looked at the control one versus the genetically abnormal one, at 4 weeks, we got the same number of motor neurons, but by 6 weeks, the development of the abnormal ones were starting to die off. So it suggests that whatever is actually killing the cells in the body can be replicated in a tissue culture plate. What's over, there had been a whole bunch of drugs screened for this condition already, because when we looked at those drugs, these little dots, these little blebs here, is what you see in normal cells. In the wild, in the genetic ones, there's none of those little blebs. This has to do with something called RNA processing. But there is drugs known to increase these blebs, and when we looked at the ones from the SMA patient, we were able to increase these blebs in the SMA patient. So we think we can replicate the disease model in a tissue culture plate, and we think we can actually look for drugs that will increase the survival of these neurons in a tissue culture plate. So that's the value of these reprogrammed cells. You can go after a particular genetic background and use them as a model in tissue culture. Now, we don't know if they're entirely equivalent. Everything in our hands says they're very close between embryonic stem cells and iPS cells. And this gets into a lot of the politics of science right now, is that people say, well, you don't need ES cells anymore. Well, at the end of the day, that might be true, but we don't know that it's true yet. And ES cells, at the very least, remain the gold standard to compare these newer cells to, because it could be they have some fatal defect we haven't seen yet. They've only been around for about a year. And my feeling is that if they're the same exact cell, scientists will generally migrate to these newer cells because they're a lot easier to work with. But if they're not the same, we should have the option of working with the older cells still. We have a little data that they seem essentially equivalent. So if you look at these newer reprogrammed cells and you look at heart cell differentiation, for example, and you look at all the pretty markers that characterize heart cells, and you look at the electrophysiology that characterizes the same heart cells, they look the exact same as embryonic stem cells. So at a first approximation, they look like they're the same cells. When we look in more detail, and this is a blood assay, it's very hard to read this slide, I apologize, but these size of these bars represent how good the different cell lines are at making blood. And these, kind of read it from here, sorry. These two right here are two iPS cell lines made from the exact same genetic material. So they should be essentially the same. But one's really good at making blood and one's not. So there is some variability between these cell lines which we don't quite understand yet. The average ability of these newer cells to make blood is essentially the same as ES cells. But when you start looking at them individually, there is some variation. That's a little troubling. A slightly more troubling one, this is the frequency of neural differentiation under very standardized conditions of both embryonic stem cells and EPS cells, these new iPS cells. ES cells have been optimized for neural differentiation over the last 10 years. You can essentially make 100% neural differentiation of the ES cells. All these other ones are iPS cells, and they're consistently less than the ES cells. And what we find now is that if we optimize these again, we can still make the neural stuff at the same frequency. But there's clearly a difference there, and we're still struggling to understand this difference, so we have some ideas. It's at least as possible that this is a real difference between embryonic stem cells and iPS cells, but it also could reflect a culture history of how the ES cells had previously been treated. So when I derived the cell lines 10 years ago, and we still use the same one from 10 years ago, we didn't know how to culture them very well. And whenever you culture things in tissue culture, you select for things that have changed because those are things that grow better and stick around. So it's very possible we selected for things that are abnormal in the left hand. It's not actually the iPS cells being different. Be that as it may, there are some slightly troubling signs that they may not be identical, and it's worthwhile keeping both around for a while. So the challenges for iPS cells and ES cell transplantation therapy are essentially the same, with the possible exception that immune rejection is no longer a problem, because you can go to a particular individual, extract their cells, make these pluripotent cells, and they're matched. They are completely matched. Again, I don't think that was ever a deal stopper for the transplantation. And if you think about some diseases like diabetes, that's not good enough because it's an autoimmune process, and if you put the exact same cells back in, they're still going to be rejected. So it's not a solution for everything. Nonetheless, that is probably is clearly an advantage. But the really hard ones, you know, preventing the process to kill the cells, the degradation of physiologic use form, they're identical to ES cells. They're back at the starting point, basically. I don't want to sound overly pessimistic here, but I want to give you a quote, and I think I'll just let you read this by yourself. Basically, there's tremendous parallels between recombinant DNA and human ES cell research. If you think about the early 1970s when recombinant DNA came along, there's a tremendous social uproar about whether we should be doing this aloud, very similar to what embryonic stem cells went through. And also, people thought that there's certain things, and scientists didn't have a very good crystal ball about the specifics about what's going to happen with recombinant DNA. They knew it was really important, and they're all excited about it, but they didn't have a very good crystal ball about predicting what the big successes and failures would be. So, for example, people thought that gene therapy would be pretty easy back then, and it's turned out to be very challenging. And there's some therapies that look very promising today, but we're 30, 35 years in now, and it's not widely pervasive and hasn't changed human medicine in a substantial way. On the other hand, for recombinant DNA, it's used everywhere in every lab, and it pervades all your basic lives in ways you don't even appreciate, like the whiter whites and tides and things. Those are recombinant proteins in your laundry detergent. It's everywhere today. So people underestimated how broadly pervasive the technology was and how broadly pervasive enabling research tool it is. It touches all of biomedical research. And I think that they also underpredicted some successes. So, for example, the genome project's now done. And I would be shocked if somebody in the middle of the 1970s would have thought that would be done by now, because I think people would have thought it would be far too technically challenging to accomplish. So we're failing on both sides. But I think for human ES cells and these newer iPS cells, we can kind of paint a similar picture. I think that the transplantation of these cells will be successful one day, but it's going to be harder than everybody thinks. And that people are very much underestimating how important these are as a very basic research tool. And it's going to pervade biomedical research in a big way that it's already starting today. And that'll change human medicine far more than the actual transplantation of these cells. Because at the end of the day, you want to understand how disease processes work so you can modulate the disease process before you have to do something as crude as transplant cells. And these cells are the key to doing that. I want to talk about one side of ethics, and this will be my last slide. And this is a reminder for me, don't bother trying to read the papers. So for the people that disagree with embryonic stem cell research, there's kind of this sigh of relief that it's all over now. And I don't think that people have thought through things quite well enough. In particular, what these two papers represent is back in the mid-90s, a fellow named Ralph Brinster figured out how to take germ cells in mice, spermatogonia stem cells from male mice, and transplant between mice. It's a very efficient procedure. So you can take the stem cell from the male germline from one individual and put it into another individual. Okay, so that doesn't sound like much. About 2 weeks after we published the human iPS cell paper, the human reprogramming paper, a scientist from Israel emailed me, and he was a plant biologist, had nothing to do with stem cells. And he said that as a child, he had a disease called medulloblastoma, which is a tumor of the brain. And he had been very aggressively treated with chemotherapy. And it was successful. He's completely cured. But now he's a young adult, and he was just recently married. And he'd like to have children, but the chemotherapy left him completely sterile. And so he asked me, would this new technology allow him to reconstitute his germline? And the answer is, it probably will. And embryonic stem cells and germ cells are really closely developmentally related, so my guess is people figure out how to do this in mice very quickly. So it could be possible to take a fibroblast from his line, turn it into a germ cell, and then put it back in his germ line so he could have natural children. And I think, you know, a lot of societies would say, well, those are his cells and he wants to have children. That's a natural process. We should let him do that. I think there'll be a lot of discussion about that, but I also think some societies will want to do that. Because he didn't ask the second question, but the second question logically was, I had a medulloblastoma, and that's a nasty disease. I want my kids having that. As long as you have the cells out, couldn't you just change a couple things and so that my kids don't have to have that? And I think, again, I think society will probably say that individual has that right. I think it'll take a little while. So with embryonic stem cells, they were originally used for making transgenic mice. And I never thought that there was much potential of abuse with embryonic stem cells because the process, I won't go into the technology, but it wouldn't be something that humans are likely to do. However, with these newer iPS cells and that germline thing, I could actually see a series of stepping stones where society might actually decide that's an okay thing to do. And I don't think we fought that through very well. And I don't think the public appreciates that that's changed recently. I'd like to end up just thanking some of the people that did this work. There's a bunch of people in my lab that contributed to these slides. But the main person I'd like to mention is Junying again, wherever she is, Junying Yu. She beavered away on the reprogramming work for about 6 years and did a great job. Thank you.
Take some questions. Are there some questions? Yes.
I'm not like a technical, like not into medicine or anything, but a lot of times you mentioned the term tissue, and I'm just curious, like I guess as a layman's point of view, like is tissue something real in the human body, like the differentiation, like this is a tissue, this is an organ, this is a cell?
So a cell is like a unit.
If I repeat the question.
Oh, sorry. I guess I'm over here. The difference between a cell, a tissue, and an organ is a real distinction between a tissue and an organ. And yes, so there are different levels of structural organization. So a cell is like a unit of one building block thing. A tissue is a local collection of different cell types, like skin tissue. And actually, it kind of blends into organ, to be honest.
Question?
Yes.
Specifically what? What do you mean?
Well, he claims that biology has become an informational technology and is therefore at the point of doubling every 18 months, and that most people working in the field are thinking things are going to take longer than they're actually going to.
I agree with part of that and not the other part. There's a tremendous acceleration right now, in part because the technology has changed so much. There's high-throughput sequencing devices, which we can get. So we have two of these high-throughput sequencing devices in my lab, and it creates 2 terabytes a week for one little lab. The flip side of that is we don't have really great ways of processing the information very well anymore. So there's a doubling of information without necessarily leading to a doubling of speeds of basic discoveries because we're still trying to deal with all that information. And there's also there's certain things that have natural rhythms that don't necessarily speed up by the number of people and things. So if you look at fields like human yes cell research, it was slowed down because of the politics. But just in normal fields, if you take the politics out of it, there's kind of a time lag and it takes off finally. And some of that has to do with cycles of things like how long the cells take to divide, which is pretty long in the case of human, and how long it takes to train a graduate student to a postdoc to go out and get their own job. So there's kind of these cycles in there that you can't necessarily break. Be that as it may, things are speeding up tremendously, and individual scientists can't keep track of everything.
Would you mind showing the second last slide again, please? Thank you.
That one?
Thank you very much.
Okay, sorry.
Yes.
I'm wondering what you may be learning about differentiation and specifically how it is communicated because, of course, each organ or tissue type kind of stops at a certain point, and then there's the other kind beyond that. And what do we know about that?
Very broad question. I'm not quite sure how to answer it.
Could you repeat the essence of it, perhaps?
Yeah, I'm not sure. It's kind of like, what do we know about developmental biology, really?
So presumably you have now have the basis for models of that.
Yeah, so the question of how a single egg becomes a whole individual is at the basics of developmental biology. And during the time that I've been, since, say, I was in high school to now, there's been tremendous strides in understanding the basics of how developmental biology works, whereas before we kind of had some phenomenological experiments about fields and things. Now we actually know the genes involved in those fields. So there's a lot known about the growth factors that induce specific developmental stages, and that's why the human yes cell work has gone so fast, is that we've parasitized a very large literature of developmental biology from zebrafish and chickens and mice, and a lot of this is conserved. So when you look at the human, a lot of that works all over again. So I'm not answering specifically about the what's, but there's a lot in there.
Right back.
I didn't hear the report, and I think I know which paper it is, but I didn't read it. It's one thing to take some neurons, put it into a mouse, and sure you get some connections, especially in a non-diseased animal. But once the structure is gone, it's hard to reconnect things in the same structure. And that's the basic point, is that when you're in a diseased state and you've wiped out all those connections, reestablishing is hard. If you have a scaffold there and there's partial structure, that's more optimistic. So in the case of, say, blindness, for example, that's one that might work because it's such a simple structure, the retina. But once the structure is entirely gone, probably not. But at early on-state blindness, you might actually get that integration because you have other cells to connect to. So in that particular case, it was an intact brain that they're connecting to, not a, not a whole.
Yes.
I found your comments regarding the potential of pharmaceutical testing using cell-based modeling. How has the pharmaceutical industry responded to the potential of possibly getting around clinical trials, and how much are pharmaceutical companies supporting your research?
So there's no direct... I made a big error, sorry. The little logo on the bottom right is my disclosure that I'm involved in such a company, and thank you for reminding me. So take what I've said with a grain of salt. Because of the politics around human yes cells, large pharma was very hesitant to get into this area. And towards the end of the Bush administration, they started to get in a little bit. And now they're jumping in big time. Pfizer has a very large program just with human yes cells, and a bunch of other drug companies are trying to look at how to use iPS cells, these neuro cells. So it's just beginning, but they understand, especially for the heart stuff, is they got really badly burned with all those things that went out. And they want to not have that happen again, and suddenly have this new material, so they're getting very interested.
Certain animals have the capacity to, for example, regrow lost limbs. Mm-hmm. Could that serve as a model of how stem cells may recreate lost structures?
Yeah, so that's... The question is certain animals like salamanders have the ability to regenerate lost rindins. Could that be a model to tell us how to do it better? Absolutely. We just got a lot of salamanders lab for precisely that reason. So salamanders are unique among vertebrates in how well they can actually reestablish limbs. And it's not really understood why they can do it. Frogs can't, for example. You lop off a frog limb, it doesn't regenerate at all. Some of that is known, but it's not clear. The process could be so complicated that it'd be hard to recapitulate even when you understand it. I think it's going to be a long time before we can regenerate human limbs. But there's actually no theoretical reason why you couldn't.
John.
Can you please tell us something about the way the cells become specific to particular functions? is it methylation that is involved?
Okay.
What's going on?
Yeah, so the question is, how does a cell become another cell with a specific function? There's several levels of organization. So the genome is packaged, and there's a linear code of DNA, but it's also modified. There's a whole bunch of proteins on the DNA called histones, and there's also things called transcription factors, which are the things that activate specific genes. So as you go from one cell to another cell, some of these transcriptions turn off, and other ones turn on, and there's networks that control this, like switches. And suddenly you have a different network of transcription factors that drive things like cardiac-specific muscle, for example. And it's a very active area of study, and again, it's what all of developmental biology studies. So there's methylation of the DNA itself, and that's generally involved in silencing things. But there's also modification of these secondary proteins called histones, and some of those are associated with genes being on and some of genes being off. And those differences are just being mapped now. So the Human Genome Project was done several years ago, and it's just now beginning to be understood.
Yes?
It sounds like the stem cell or ISL would be a very good environment for doing studies of the sources of cancer or the heroes that are coming. I presume that something like that is going on.
Yeah, there's probably a lot of people doing that in our institute. The idea that the studying the reprogrammed cells is understanding the genesis of cancer. There's an investigator, Igor Slutkin, the fellow that did those blood slides, that's very interested in leukemia. And he's looking at the accumulations of mutations in the leukemic cells and in the somatic cells reprogrammed to a leukemia-like state. So he is doing that kind of thing, yeah.
What this relates to the differentiation of how you get an embryonic cell to become some differentiated cell that you want. You said you used a culture.
Yeah, so the question is, how do you make one cell into another in a practical way? Well, one way you can do it empirically and just try a bunch of stuff. But usually what you do is you go to the literature and find out from, like, zebrafish what growth factors, what little molecules we think induce things, and then you try to add those to the tissue culture plate. So there's the outside-in approach where you actually add little proteins to the mix, and those signal things in the cells to become something else. There's also kind of inside-out approach where you know these transcription factors on the inside of the cells, and you can actually introduce those to do things in a more direct way. So both are done. So in the case of the neural stuff that I showed you, there's a huge amount of information from other organisms, so they knew what growth factors to add to make dopamine neurons and things.
Yes?
There's such a problem with some diseases like Crohn's and arthritis where they use a drug called Enbrel, which they produce from injecting a mouse and getting monoclonal antibodies. Has to do with TNF-alpha antibodies in the human. The cure costs about $20,000 a year for the treatment rather. Can you comment on any advances in that area of medicine having to do with autoimmune response?
I'm afraid it's a little outside my field. Yeah, it's extremely complex, and if people knew how to do it well, diabetes would be cured because that's precisely what it is. It's an autoimmune process, and if you could retune the immune system before all the cells were killed, you've cured those cells also, which is why just looking for the pancreatic beta cells is kind of short-sighted. It's the immune system that's more important there.
Thank
you. And I understand you mentioned that one of the problems using these cells is trying to recreate the arrangement and the structure that originally existed. Now, in the process of human development, there is a structure that's created. So are these cells programmed to create a structure in the process of development?
Yeah, so the question is, are these cells programmed to create a structure? At some level, yes. Like when I showed you those teratomas and a tooth formed, well, clearly they have a self-assembling ability. But it's one thing to grow some little thing to a big thing, and it's another thing to have a big thing with a hole in it. And someday this might be possible. I'm just saying it's going to be hard, that's all. I mean, these cells do have the ability to form any structure in the human body if you treated them appropriately, but it's still going to be hard to get them wired up right.
Yes?
What about research being done to restore the myelin in case of transverse myelitis and spinal cord injury?
Yeah, I got to be careful because I'm not a neurobiologist and it's not my field. The transplants that are being done with the embryonic stem cells, which is a company called Geron, the idea is not to actually repair the spinal cord itself. It's to prevent the response that actually does all the damage. So you have to get the patient right after the injury, and it's a protective response so that the cord isn't actually cured. So it's the same problem with the spinal cord is once it's severed, you've got to connect all those little things again, and there are people who think that'll be possible someday, but it's going to be hard.
One last question, yes.
I wondered how much international collaboration there has been experienced in this sort of research. It seems to be controversial in North America, but I suspect that in China and Europe and so forth, there are lots of advancements. Could you tell us something about that?
Yeah, it's been kind of a hodgepodge. The States, the question is, what's the international scene in embryonic stem cell research, and is it cooperation, and is the United States behind the rest of the world, basically? The Bush administration didn't do the United States many favors in terms of ESL research. And I think, I think there's a greater parity in this particular area of research in the world than for most biomedical research. But the United States is usually pretty dominant in biomedical research, but because of the Bush administration, I think there's a greater equality in this. That being said, the United States is still doing pretty well. In terms of collaborations, academic collaborations tend to be pretty, I'd have to say, opportunistic. Basically, if you're not a scientist, I guess you might think of scientists, striving to do good things as opposed to being little competitive people. but the model that actually kind of makes sense to think about is it's kind of like small businesses. If you're a principal investigator and you got a team of 30 people, you want your business to survive, you'll once in a while make a collaboration with another business that can help you, but it's usually short-term and opportunistic. And you can look at it in a negative way, but competition is what motivates people too. So, in terms of international collaborations, in my own lab, I've collaborated with people in Britain, people in Canada, especially in Vancouver here. But a lot of the international efforts have been very internally focused into single countries.
Okay. There will be coffee and cookie afterwards. I'd like to call on the Dean of Science, Simon Peacock, to come and thank our speaker.
Well, thank you, Jamie, for a wonderful talk that shared with us not just the fundamental... challenges and yet the possibilities.